This interview is sponsored by Walker Corporate Law. Do you need a lawyer? That's not the local guy who doesn't really get startups, not the really expensive guys who want a piece of your business, the one who really understands the startup community and is there to help you? If you do, go to Scott Edward Walker of Walker Corporate Law. It's also sponsored by Grasshopper. Do you need a phone number where your customers can dial in, press 1 to go to sales, press 2 to go to customer service, etc., and maybe even all those numbers actually lead to your cell phone, but it makes you look big? Do you need that kind of feature and so many others? Go to grasshopper.com. All right, let's get started. Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I am the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. How does a founder who says that he tried everything finally build a successful business? That's what I want to find out in this interview, because after his previous business failed, that's exactly what Roger Dickey did. He tried multiple product ideas and then he found his hit. He's the founder of Curiosoft, a company that he sold to Zynga soon after launching it. Roger, welcome.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Good to be here.
You're also incredible with user acquisition. And I know in your pre-interview, you talked to Jeremy about different specific tactics for getting users. And I want to talk to you about that within this interview, too.
Great.
The biggest thing that you did, the one that got the most users, was it Mafia Wars?
Yes, that's correct.
I remember
about 100 million users for that game.
500 million users.
100 million users.
100 million users. On which platform?
Completely on Facebook to start out with. Eventually, we moved it onto MySpace as well. We tried an iOS app for it. To be clear, I helped get the team started, grew it to a certain size, and then there was a great group of people that took it further from there. I think it's actually still live. It's been running for 5 years.
Yep. And on your LinkedIn profile, it says, where is that? Curiosoft, 19 apps in 2007, largest app, Dope Wars, had 300 million monthly paid views, 2.5 million annual profit.
That's right.
And that was before you sold.
That's before, correct.
Unbelievable. And how long did it take you to go through these 19 apps that you built before you found the one that was the big hit?
The great thing about the early Facebook platform was users didn't expect a high degree of fidelity. So it was easy to experiment quickly, make an app in 3, 4, or 5 days, at most a week, to try a concept. If you launched the app and people liked it, they'd start sharing it with their friends. The viral channels on Facebook at that point were still very fertile ground for growth. So we pretty much knew within a couple days of launching something if it had a chance. We'd maybe make one or two tweaks. That point, if the app wasn't successful, we'd move on to the next one. So we pretty much did about one a week. When I say we, I had a co-founder and we had a couple of interns at UT Austin until we finally found Dope Wars. We knew other people had some success with games, but we had a broader thesis around social software, thinking we'd find some other app that would do well or that would catch people's attention. Maybe like a new type of Microsoft Office. Turned out, though, after everything we tried, the social software people wanted was games and dating sites. Well, also quizzes and horoscopes and other things that didn't monetize as well, but games and dating sites did the best.
All right, I want to understand the evolution of your thinking and how you went from launching the company to figuring it out and getting the success. But what about the business that you did before? Maybe we can talk about Turtle Tutors. What was the original idea for that?
So everybody has their first startup, if you could call it that. This was the first group project I did that we even tried to call a company. It was me and a couple of friends in Austin. One of the co-founders was a piano tutor, and he had a lot of experience with students. I think he had 40 or 50 active students. Sometimes they wouldn't pay. Sometimes they'd miss scheduled appointments. He had this kind of blurb that he'd email out to people on Craigslist. So he was using all these traditional channels that were frustrating. And we thought, okay, tutoring's a big market. We live in Austin, which is one of the largest college towns in the nation. Why don't we launch a business to kind of help college kids tutor adults and high school children? And then we can scale that to every other university in the States and eventually sort of non-university towns. So that was the inspiration. We worked on it for about 6 months, focused on all the wrong things. We took a month or two to come up with a name and the logo, really silly things like that that kind of were putting the cart before the horse. We didn't go out and talk to customers. We didn't start out trying to prove we'd found the right product. We didn't try to sort of find product market fit for it. So probably after 6 or 7 months of doing that, it didn't seem to be going anywhere. My co-founders got job offers and left. So that was the first kind of awkward startup, like that first awkward relationship we've all had.
The idea was solid. I actually have interviewed two entrepreneurs who built companies that are similar to what you described. Peer-to-peer Tutors was one. Wiseant was another company that that I did an interview about. Essentially the same model. The idea was good. I understand that you didn't talk to customers and that maybe you should have, but what did you miss because you weren't talking to customers? What did your product... Yeah, what did you miss because you didn't talk to customers?
We had a lot of internal conversations where we tried to sort of play our intuitions against each other on what people would want, what would be the right, you know, even things like the right name, the right launch strategy, what's a good first vertical to focus on. So is it music lessons? Is it language lessons? It was always sort of like my word against a co-founder's word. We could have saved a lot of time if we just said, hey, here are a few hypotheses. How do we go out and test these hypotheses? We didn't do as much of that as we should have. We should have just written down the questions, kind of stack ranked by what are the biggest risks we see. Like, you know, number one, is it something tutors even want to use? Number two, how many different verticals is this applicable to? Number three, would customers want to engage? You know, and then you have other issues, the kind of things you hear VCs ask about. Like, are people going to disintermediate you? What's your strategy to add enough value as the glue layer? Things like that. We didn't know what questions to ask, what order to answer them in, and really we weren't diligent about answering them properly.
I see. And then what did the product look like? I mean, how much was built?
Actually, my girlfriend did most of the art for it. We were really scrappy. We obviously didn't go try to raise funding first, which was smart. At least we tried to actually build it ourselves. We had this pretty simple looking user interface. There was a turtle. It was mostly green. It kind of had this anthropomorphic nature. You looked like you were kind of, but play up this metaphor of you being in kind of like learning in a natural environment, learning in nature. So there was grass on the background, things like that. It was kind of stupid looking, honestly, in retrospect. But the first couple of people who used it liked it. You know, I mean, things like user interface, really, it's not the right thing to focus on. Look at Craigslist. Look at eBay. Really, really simple products that haven't evolved much since they launched. That just do one core thing well. The value on a site like that, on a site like Craigslist, is that there's listings. It doesn't matter that it's through white background, black text.
I see. And so when it didn't work, by the way, is it painful to talk about this? I feel a little bit bad bringing it up, and I'm looking at you to try to gauge whether it's okay, whether you feel comfortable with it or not. Instead of just looking, I'll ask you, is it tough to talk about?
It's not tough to talk about. Maybe if I hadn't sort of hit an inflection point professionally after that, this would have hurt a little more. But instead, it was a learning experience, and you know, it's like recounting memories. You know, awkward childhood memories. You have a chance to reflect on how much you've grown.
Yeah. Then afterwards, it's so easy for entrepreneurs who don't have any outside validation to see a setback as evidence that they never were meant to succeed anyway, or some other, we blow up the significance of it. How did you handle yours?
For me, I've always worked on projects since a very young age. I've just had an internal drive to build complex things, complex systems with multiple parts, and sort of bring them to an audience. So at a young age, I'd write games, put them on floppy disks, bring them to school. People play them on DOS. If a kid was playing a game that I wrote, a kid who I didn't know, that means somebody copied the disk and given it to him. You know, like it was going viral in a way, right?
I see. Yeah.
So those were those were kind of the first experiences I had with building consumer products, so to speak. And that was always very addictive to me. So I didn't so much see it as like, okay, I've failed. Should I stop doing this? It was always just the default for me to build products and bring them to audiences. So failures were really just information for me. I don't think anything could throw me off the drive I have. And you know, it's not just me. A lot of people I know in Silicon Valley who are successful entrepreneurs, kind of talk this way. This is one of the things you know, entrepreneurs should look for in themselves when they're asking, should I be an entrepreneur? And you know, it's something to look for as a hiring manager if you're hiring entrepreneurial talent. This kind of drive to never give up. You know, not did somebody go to Harvard, not do they have a 160 IQ, but are they smart enough to get the job done, and are they going to sit there and passionately, tirelessly, you know, grind away? So kind of in, you know, when you start a company, the company starts with no employees, and then the first question is like, do you want to hire yourself as a CEO? So I've always felt it was appropriate to hire myself to work on my own projects because I know I have that drive.
And you were also working as a software engineer at National Instruments the whole time. So did that soften the blow, the fact that you had a job?
It actually did. I think, especially on the financial side, this can always be challenging for people. It can always be a reason not to start a company. If you have a job and you can take a leave of absence, that's probably one of the best ways to do it. That's actually what I did. Quitting is probably the second best thing to do if you have savings. Distant third or fourth would be trying to do it as a weekend project or a side project. The problem with that is one's level of motivation for a project is often tied to kind of the sensation of momentum or forward progress. So there's very much kind of an exponential effect to putting effort in, seeing a return or a reward and wanting to work harder. If you work on a side project and only give it 10, 20 hours a week, it might never go anywhere. So you might never even have that motivation to see the product through to a launch. You need to actually give yourself time to focus on it so that it has the oxygen to grow and to keep that motivation engine running.
And is that why, after you closed down Turtle Tutors, after you realized that this business wasn't going to be the business for you, instead of saying, I'm going to spend more time working on at my company, at my job, you said a couple of months later, it seems like you said, all right, I think I need to go and be a full-time entrepreneur.
That's right. I had made a decision around 3 months before I started Turtle Tutors that I was going to start a company of some sort. Mm-hmm. It was just the natural progression to the type of projects I'd always been doing. I found I wasn't able to really do those projects in the corporate environment. I tried my best. I had done, you know, sort of unsolicited things, shown them to my boss, and he's like, oh, that's cool, but why aren't you doing the, you know, software engineering tasks you've been given? That kind of thing. So what I realized was if I wanted to work on a project and I wanted to involve other people, other adults who had busy schedules and jobs, there had to be some money in it for them. And if you're working on a project that makes money, that's a business. So it just sort of naturally turned into that for me. And I realized that the next thing I did would be a business. And if Turtle Tutors didn't work, I'd do something else.
Wow. And weren't you afraid at that point? You see, before you start a business, you think I thought anyway, before I started a business, I was so smart. I was one of the people who did all my homework, who studied, who was passionate about business. I wasn't going to fail. People who failed didn't care as much as I did, weren't as smart as I did. Then I started a business and I saw, ooh, maybe I'm vulnerable a little bit. I still believed I could do anything, but I was vulnerable. I don't know that when I really came into contact with my vulnerability, if that would have been the time where I felt confident enough to quit a job and go full time, but you did. Weren't you at least a little scared now that you saw that, no, not everything's going to work out?
The leave of absence helped. I was willing to quit my job anyways, because the experience of being an entrepreneur and particularly this this market I was going after, the Facebook market, had been demystified for me. So somebody really helped, my co-founder really helped to make it easy for me to leave and to do this. I was fortunate to have that kind of resource available to me. It's really hard to do something alone. I recommend to everyone who's starting their first business to have a co-founder, because you need emotional support. And at that phase of your life as an entrepreneur, you won't know many other entrepreneurs who will kind of give you the time of day and help you through it. You need somebody there with you every day in the office. And you need to know that you need to really know and feel inside and internalize that what you're doing is possible. Otherwise, you won't have that confidence. You won't have that motivation to do it. My co-founder told me an app he made that he spent 8 hours working on was making $2,000 a day in revenue. I mean, that's $700,000 a year. I was making less than a tenth of that at my job, and I had to go. I just show up to the office every day, not just spend 8 hours building something and launch it. Right. So it was, hearing that was really inspiring. When I meet entrepreneurs who are on the fence, one of the first things I try to do is demystify entrepreneurship for them and say, look, Facebook, Instagram, this billion-dollar outcome started off as a couple of guys in their garage and didn't sort of, and you hear a lot of those stories, the, you know, couple guys in a garage story, but usually there's like a dot, 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 then they had a $1 billion exit. I try to go into even more detail and say they were in a garage, then they did this thing, then they hit this inflection point. You know, four or five of those later, they sold for $1 billion. But, you know, there are too many layers of indirection between sort of that garage startup and the $1 billion exit for most people to really believe it. So you've got to demystify it, I think.
That's what I'd like to do here. And I can see, by the way, that you are now, after having done so well, you are helping a lot of other entrepreneurs. I met you through AJ Forsyth, the co-founder of iCracked, where you're an investor. Yeah. You're also an investor in Lookcraft, in High Gear, in eLacart, Facebook, right, and a bunch of other companies, and an advisor to many others too. So you now had this co-founder. Who is the co-founder? I'll be honest with you. As you were saying co-founder, I was Googling to see if I could find his name, because I don't see it in my notes. And he doesn't come up on AngelList. He doesn't come up on a Google search. Who's the co-founder?
So he likes to stay off the radar. I don't know if I should share his name. He's a very private individual.
He doesn't even want to be known as the co-founder?
No. It's strange. In Silicon Valley, you see a lot of people who chase press and chase kind of recognition, like to go to parties and like to play the role of CEO and speak. He's kind of the opposite of all that. He's a very private guy. When we sold to Zynga, he didn't want to be involved at Zynga. He took some cash in the exit and kind of went his own way. I couldn't even tell you where he is right now.
Really? So how did you guys know each other?
We met in college. He was a senior when I was a freshman at University of Illinois.
Okay. And so why would he come to you and show you what he was making instead of saying, I'm a private person, I'll keep generating revenue and ideas on Facebook, I don't need Roger to know any of this?
He and I have always been close. Okay. So after he graduated freshman year, he started an organization at school. About 40 or 50 engineers joined. I was one of the most active contributors to this kind of program or organization. Then he graduated and went on to work on a couple of entrepreneurial projects, which I helped with in spare time at school. And I might have helped him a little bit during one of the summers. So we kind of always had kind of an on again, off again professional relationship. And then about 2 years after I graduated from college and I'd been working on this job, he was finally doing something that I felt had a chance. And it was the right timing. I wanted to start something. I was willing to quit my job. Facebook was great, and kind of mobile now would be the new platform. If you're an engineer, a product guy like myself, but you have no idea how to market a product, because the marketing is built into the platform. So that's kind of what excited me about it and got me to make that jump.
All right, I can see that. Why did he want to work with you then?
he and I were a good pair. We were kind of both these strong generalists, product people, engineers, and I think we had the same kind of energy, the same culture. We were both tireless workers, 100 hours a week plus on what we did. We didn't leave the apartment. I got showered once a week. He ate nothing but popcorn. My girlfriend would make him popcorn. I had these $1 TV dinners, one or two per meal. That was a lifestyle, and we loved it. It was probably the best 4 or 5 months of my life.
Wow. So on a site called gotinterviews.com, you said that line that I mentioned at the top of the interview where you felt like you tried everything. And I tried to make a list of what I found that you did. You had just apps, social games like Dress Friends and Funny Outfits, vaguely dating related apps, tool for connecting friends who are 2 or 3 degrees away, and Dope Wars. Can you walk me through the evolution of your thinking? What was the first direction that you guys went in?
Man, that's a great question. If I had 5 or 10 minutes to research it, I could probably answer that for you. We made, you know, like I said, 19 apps. I think the first one I made was we tried to play off of we tried to play off of existing behaviors we saw on the Facebook platform. So at that time, you could put a profile box on your Facebook profile specifically for the app. So the app could control some real estate there. Mm-hmm. So we were thinking, you know, how do we grow quickly? Well, the key to growing quickly is to get everybody to want to add this profile box when they see a friend having the profile box. Mm-hmm. So we made this little game where you could send people pizzas. I don't know where we got the idea, but you could send them slices of pizza. You could make your own pizza. So people would go to the game. They would make pizza, which kind of got people to visit. And then they would share those pizzas with friends, and those friends could only get the pizza on their profile. So it was kind of a way to get people to get these profile boxes out there. But after a while, it kind of lost its luster, and people were onto whatever the next app was. So I think after that we tried to stay closer to the social paradigms on Facebook messaging. We tried one app where you could message your friends match rating as a celebrity. So you could message your friend as like Sean Connery or Tom Cruise or whatever. That was a funny one. We did a number of different social apps until we finally made Dope Wars, which really was probably the most engaging thing we did. The one with the best shot at monetization. It was the first game we made and was an instant hit.
Was there an intentional goal to try a lot of little projects until you found the one that hit?
There was, yeah. Yeah, my co-founder and I were kind of mentally and emotionally prepared to have a few failures. What I wasn't emotionally prepared for was as many failures as we ended up having. I didn't know we'd have 17 or 18 apps that would essentially fail for different reasons. Some would take off, grow exponentially for a while, and then later fail. It was really, really hard for me to do that and kind of throw away all that engineering effort because I was sitting there coding basically all the apps myself. So we were prepared, but it's always hard.
Yeah. You actually said, I don't remember where I saw this online, but you said, if not for your co-founder, you would have given up.
I think I might've, you know, not 100%, but there were some pretty dark days where, you know, we launched something I'd sat and worked on for 3-4 straight days in a row, maybe 50 hours, 60 hours. And it would fail within 2 days. You know, and then it was on to the next project.
How do you know within 2 days that it failed?
Because the platform was such fertile ground for viral growth.
So within 2 days, if it doesn't take off, you don't need to do anything like get a PR or try to tweak it. You just know it failed.
We would sometimes try to make tweaks if we had intuition for why they had failed. But at that point, everyone was just sort of, now you hear about A-B testing and there's people A-B testing, you know, button sizes and colors and, you know, where do I put this, the payment call to action? At that point, we were A/B testing, like, what products do people even want on this platform? You know, do they want productivity software? Do they want games? Do they want like some Craigslist marketplace type experience? So there were just a lot of question marks. There was a lot of feeling around that had to be done.
So, Roger, one of the things that I'm seeing is there's some entrepreneurs who, like John Herring, the founder of Lookout, spent a long time trying to figure out his product, trying to figure out which market he should be in. I think at first I remember him going on to iOS app market, the App Store, and then I think he found his groove in Android. But it took a while. And then I see entrepreneurs like you who are going for much shorter tests. Do you feel that there's a right approach here, or is it just different styles, or is it based on the platform that you're on, that if something's growing so quickly, you know if it's a hit or not quickly? What do you make of this dichotomy?
Well, for anyone who hasn't read the book Lean Startup, or at least read, you know, a pretty comprehensive summary of it, I'd kind of preface this by saying do that first. I could go into detail specifically what they say, but you might as well just read it online.
Yep.
The general gist and takeaway is really, you know, different for every business. Even if you're starting a restaurant, there's a way to kind of ghetto test, or so to speak, or like cheaply test your idea before you go like lease a space, hire employees, print menus and signage, get on Yelp. I mean, there's all these things you can do that really don't get you any closer to figuring out if your concept will work, versus, you know, a friend of mine was trying to start a pizza restaurant. So he and I went to a local park. This is a true story. And we got a converted Coleman oven or Coleman grill, turned it into a pizza oven, made pizzas that used his new recipe. And we went around and just handed them to people. And a friend of ours was a videographer, recorded a video of people's reactions, and rolled that into a video that we're using now actually to raise money. So we were able to basically do all of that I just described for about $900, and got a bunch of great reactions from people of all ages, races, genders, you know, demographics. With a website, there's a lot of cheap ways to test as well. So some people go to sites like unbounce.com. They'll make landing pages that are actually fake. They're not even real websites. And they'll just buy Facebook ads, you know, put $100 into Facebook ads and see how they convert. Yeah. So there's a lot of really cheap things you can do. The way you can tell kind of how to order those tests is in the order of biggest risks to your business. Stack rank those and say, you know, the first one is people might not want this. Okay, so ask 100 people in a park if they want it, or run an ad. The second one is like, can I build this? So do some research if you can build it, you know, whatever, et cetera. You just go down those and test one by one.
What do you think it was about the hit that worked?
About Dope Words?
Sorry, Dope Words.
A couple of things. Grand Theft Auto had been a successful game. The crime genre has always worked well for gaming. It's fun. It feels risque. It's even funny to joke about different things related to like crime or drugs, I guess. That was the case in this game. People had a lot of fun with it, you know, dealing drugs with their mom virtually, things like that. So we had... I think we had a lot of people kind of try it because it had this like shock value. If you get a link to it, you're a lot more likely to click. And then once they got in, it was a very engaging experience. You started with a certain amount of money, and then you basically would start kind of buying low and selling high. It's just sort of a commodities trading simulation using drugs and crime as the theme. So people got really into that. It was easy, but not too easy. So you know, you could go and see, oh, you know, a bag of weed in New York costs this amount, in Amsterdam it costs this amount, so if I buy it here and sell it here, I make money. You know, so people are able to kind of zone out, but they feel like they're doing something that's not just kind of clicking squares in Farmville or clicking little jewels in Bejeweled.
How did you figure out what revenue model to put in it?
We actually never really solved revenue. We were making a lot of money, but it was just on ads. $7,000 or $8,000 a day on ads. So
oh,
that
I
was
see. Really,
you know, $2.5 to $3 million a year just on advertising. If we'd gone in and put virtual goods in, it would have done much better. We ended up kind of trying that later once we sold to Zynga. That's one of the reasons Zynga bought us. But it never did as well in, with virtual goods as we wanted, because the whole game was designed around the advertising revenue model.
Why did you, well, before I get into that question, why did you sell? How did it feel after having tried so many different things to finally have one that just blew up?
It wasn't a sudden, like, oh my God, we've solved it feeling. Because at every point along the way, like, you know, we'd have this success, we'd move kind of like two steps forward, but then we'd end up, you know, going one or two steps back, with whether it was a server issue or users complaining about bugs in the forums, running a $3 million business completely by yourself, doing everything, including art, bug fixing, community management, business, advertising. Doing that is a very much a full-time and kind of stressful endeavor. So there was always something broken in some part of the business, and that wore on me, you know, kind of emotionally. So there'd be those euphoric days where, like, you wake up and, you know, your revenues are up from the previous day and nothing's broken and your users seem happy in the forums, and you can kind of take a breather. But then, you know, the next day something would break. So I never had kind of this sudden, like, eureka moment, but there was over time the feeling that, you know, okay, I finally built something that's working. And when I take a step back and, like, look at what I've done objectively, look at the numbers, it's a big achievement. But I'd have to take a step back and kind of look at it. I'd have to get out of the weeds and get out of the trees and see the forests.
Why did you decide to sell?
For a lot of the reasons I just mentioned, it was very, very stressful to do it alone. At this point, my co-founder wanted to move on. He had something else he wanted to do. The business was doing well, but it didn't work for him philosophically. He had a different direction he wanted to pursue that kind of was a better fit for him. So he disengaged from that business, and I ended up, you know, we had a couple of acquisition offers. I spurned everyone for as long as I could. And then the thing with an acquisition offer is it's kind of a strategic weapon from a large company's M&A group. They're able to kind of plant that seed in your mind that if you ever want to give up, we're there, you know?
And now it's in your mind. And when things are tough, how do you feel?
Yeah. You know, it's like Inception, you know, when it's like 3 o'clock in the morning and your product's broken, you're like, well, shit, I could just sell, right? So a lot of these companies, I think Zynga's strategy actually was to go kind of talk to everybody and plant that seed in everybody's mind, whether they bought you or not. They actually did talk to a lot of people, which I think is, you know, devious but smart. So that ended up working on me. And one day I just decided to bid them up a little bit and take the offer.
At that point, were you alone, or was your co-founder still working in the business day to day?
We were physically in the same space, but we were working on different things already at the point that we sold.
Really? So didn't you feel betrayed? Here you were building this business, dealing with issues even as you guys were growing, and he was working on his own thing?
It was upsetting. He never believed that a big business could be built on the Facebook platform. He thought Facebook was a toy. He just wanted to use it to drive marketing towards a different project he was doing. Turned out he was mistaken on that point, at least in the short term. You know, there's no like $10 billion business in social gaming, but there's a $1 billion business, which is a lot bigger than anything I think he was planning to work on. I felt that there were feelings of kind of betrayal, and, you know, it always feels bad to kind of split up with somebody you've been close to, whether it's professionally or romantically or a friend, whatever. It always feels bad, but I had security in just knowing that my path was right. I disagreed with his perspective that there was nothing valuable to do on Facebook, and I think one of the things that had gotten me through the whole time and had gotten me to that point was the clear vision I had that Facebook was a platform to build on, and there'd be a big business there, and there was a lot of potential. And that ended up getting me through the kind of co-founder breakup, was just knowing that, hey, I'm going the right direction. If he doesn't understand that or can't come with me, you know, it's nothing else I can do.
And you ended up owning the company the day that you sold on your own?
I had most of it. I gave him a little.
Okay. And then you sold. How did it feel the day after the sale went through?
It was pretty amazing. That was probably, if there was like kind of a euphoric moment through the process, that was it. It was kind of the bookend to the entire experience, and it was something I could kind of hang my hat on and tell my parents and say like, hey, look, I'm not doing this little side project anymore. This is actually a real business. We've sold to a real funded company with legitimate entrepreneurs. You know, I'm now moving to San Francisco. It was a big life change for me in a lot of ways. I'd always wanted to live in California though, so it was just really, really kind of positive all around, and ended up being a huge inflection point for me.
Did they do all cash or cash and stock or just stock?
Both parties in the transaction wanted to push kind of as much stock as possible. Okay. Zynga was valuing their stock pretty highly because they just raised a round. So that was, they were motivated to kind of give that stock out instead of cash so they could retain the cash for other acquisitions or to do ads. Mm-hmm. I wanted stock because I saw the acquisition as an investment. It was the first investment I was making, and I wanted to invest in the winning social gaming player. So I remember when I sold to Zynga and looking at the acquisition price, I was like, okay, this is great, but it's really going to be 6 times this because I know that Zynga is at least going to 6x from where it is. And it turned out the company, I think it was at 1.100x when I had sold. So wow. They ended up doing very well. Definitely.
When did you sell?
Beat expectations. Early 2008.
Okay. By then, early 2008, so this is before they went public, right?
Well before. Yeah, they went public, I think, 2011, after a few quarters of consecutive massive growth.
Wow. So how did life change after you sold your shares?
After I sold my Zynga shares?
Yeah.
That didn't happen until much later. I didn't actually do that until after I left Zynga post-IPO.
I see. Okay. I thought you were saying that you sold your shares in 2008. No, you're saying you sold the company in 2008, launched 2007, sold 2008, and then sold your shares after they went public.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I mean, in terms of life after the exit, I didn't have, since I was mostly a stock sale, I didn't have that much cash liquidity. So, you know, I didn't go like, you know, buy a Ferrari and get a nice house kind of thing. I think convenient, like a lot of people, convenience is a thing I look for most in life. So having a laundry service and not having to look at prices on menus anymore, and like not caring if like the salmon's $10, but the steak is like $15. I would just get the steak, you know, that sort of thing. Like how much does it cost really to spend on average 5 or 10 more per meal you eat out? You know, you're talking like $1,000 a month. So, and the laundry service was another $500 to $1,000 a month, and maybe a maid to help out around the house, that kind of thing. So I added a few kind of convenience elements to my life, but it didn't change things too much.
Did you feel like, were you a millionaire right after the sale, after you sold the stock?
On paper, I guess. Yeah, certainly on paper. But you know, again, like the difference between having wealth on paper and having actual concrete wealth became very clear to me after Zynga IPO'd, and there was some volatility in the stock price.
But you did sell. And what year did you sell?
I ended up, what are we in now? 2013. I sold sometime this year. You know, it's different. I sold different bits at different times, but, you know, I did sell a chunk of it this year as well.
There's one other thing I want to ask about, and then I want to get into, sorry, I'm taking so long to even get to them, these, specific tips for user acquisition, but Mafia Wars, whose idea was that?
Mafia Wars. So, So Dope Wars, my co-founder and I at Curiosoft had the idea for Dope Wars. Mm-hmm. And then Dope Wars inspired an app called Mob Wars. And I've actually since met the creator of Mob Wars. He's sort of an acquaintance here in San Francisco, which is cool. After I joined Zynga, we kind of saw the rise of Mob Wars, and there was a lot of, since the names are so similar and they're both crime themed and they're both RPGs, there were a lot of internal comparisons around, okay, Mob Wars is doing these revenue numbers, Dope Wars is doing these revenue numbers, how do we bridge the gap and beat Mob Wars? And we eventually realized that while Dope Wars was kind of a great property to have as an early company, Zynga didn't want to align their brand around a drug dealing game, basically. And Mob Wars was doing better. So we had to do something in the mafia space. Mm-hmm. So I went to Mark one evening, it might have been June of 2008, and I was just like, look, we need a mafia game. I want to start working on it right now. Can I do that? And he said yes. So I went and grabbed some engineers I've been working with. We all piled into a conference room, and 10 minutes after the decision was made to start the project, we designed the whole thing. I think they laid down some code that night, and 2.5 weeks later, we launched Mafia Wars and Pirate Wars, which is a pirate-themed RPG, both on Facebook and MySpace. We did 4 simultaneous launches in about 2.5 weeks.
And that's a whole other launch than the kind of launch that you were able to do on your own. Suddenly, things are polished. I remember even at launch time, when you guys had your iPhone app, it was beautiful. It blew away other similar games. Mm-hmm. What is it like to have all those resources?
Well, I wasn't involved with the iPhone game. I was only sort of very early on the founding team of Mafia Wars and kind of scaling it a little from there.
I see.
The later work that was done, the fidelity moved up and up. I think a few years after launch, we did this event with Snoop Dogg in the Las Vegas desert. Where Snoop Dogg blew up an armored car and there was this video and we got 10 million people to watch it, something like that. So, it became more of like a media franchise. That's how we viewed it later, because the property was doing, I think this is public now, it was doing a tremendous amount of revenue. It was doing maybe a third of the company's revenue.
So lately I've been asking entrepreneurs to turn on their computers privately and show me their base camp. Show me how they launch new products. Show me what goes into it. And what I'm noticing is that often they'll have base camp with a list of check boxes. They know what it takes to launch a new product or create new software, and they have it all laid out, and it's kind of a template. And in base camp, all they do is hit copy and they start going to work. Did you start out that way with Zynga too? Was there a list of things that have to go into an app to make it successful? Or were you just winging it the way you were as an entrepreneur, except now with more resources?
Even with the team that made the first version of Mafia Wars, I think mm-hmm. we were 4 or 5. We used Notepad and email for project management.
Really?
I would go in and make a list. I had a certain template I used to build a product spec. And I would go, whenever we were building a new game, I think I might have built 10 games at Zynga. I'd go into my format, fill it in, share it with the team. As my team got bigger and bigger, at one point when I was running Fishville, we had maybe 40, 45 people at the most. I would have people on staff who would make nice specs, but I would always send them that clean text version that was just flat.
What was in that flat text version?
It kind of endeavored to drill down from kind of the broad to the specific. So at the top level, like what's kind of the vision of this project? Like what's existing user behavior or user kind of media franchise that we're targeting? Like in the case of Mafia, people already watch shows about the Mafia, like The Sopranos. There's movies like Godfather that are cultural icons. So starting from something like that, saying like, okay, now obviously we have Facebook. Looking at competitors was kind of somewhere up there on the list. Coming down to how we'd be different and better. I think part of the document was like a thematic study. So painting a picture of the theme space and saying, okay, within the mafia theme, within the mafia fiction, you have concepts like crime jobs. So you have apprentices, you have mob bosses, you have prohibition era. So we took all that and we'd make a big list of everything. And then once we had a sense of what features we wanted based on like what business KPIs we wanted to kind of to be strong in the product, we'd go and map kind of fiction and theme onto those KPIs. So you could say something like, okay, well, we know we want a feature that's really viral, that gets people to invite their friends. How do we do that? Oh, well, in the fiction space, we have this concept of a mob. Like you have people in a mob who hang out and work together. So we decided, okay, we'll make everyone have their own mob and they have to invite their friends into their mob. You know,
that goal was on the checklist. And then you just had to think of within this theme, how do you hit that goal, which is to make it social?
Yeah. So then that would turn into a feature. The feature would be like, you know, like mafia list, like friend mafia list and invite button. And that would be kind of at the bottom of the document.
I see.
Okay. So it kind of like started broad and then got down at the bottom to a really concrete spec of what we were actually going to build.
And I imagine, Roger, that after each product that you build using this spec sheet or this template, you figure out what you could have done better and then you go and change the template so that next time it's improved.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So here are the tips that you and Jeremy talked about. I think the easiest way for me to do this without having you go back and look through the list is, how about if I read the tip as you guys wrote it and you can maybe give an example or talk about it?
Okay. I can do that. I've got about 5 or 10 minutes.
Okay. Definitely get it in that time. Why don't we start with the first one, which is go to the platform that's getting tons of traffic or you think is going to in the future. And you guys, we saw how you did that with Dope Wars, but how do you figure out where those platforms are? And is there always a platform, or did it happen to be, you know, that you happen to be around in the days that Facebook was taking off, but it's not usual?
That's a great question. There's not always an opportunity the size of Facebook. There's not always something that's kind of that green field. They come and go in waves. So you know, everyone's sort of the .com boom. That was sort of an era where there was a disparity between the amount of opportunity and the number of qualified entrepreneurs pursuing that opportunity. That ratio was much greater than one, you know, i.e. there was a lot more opportunity than entrepreneurs. So everyone that got into that space, who was halfway competent and motivated, was able to make a couple of $1 million off the website, or you know, start a business they could sell for a couple hundred thousand, or make some money off of ads, whatever it is. Facebook was the next .com boom. It was, you know, smaller in magnitude, but still very big. Mobile is kind of the current boom. Google Glass could be a new one in the future. 3D printing
between these booms. There was a period there between Facebook and the .com boom where things just seemed kind of blah. In those moments, do we still start a company, or you're just saying, actually, yeah, what do we do in those moments before I go into making that decision?
Yeah. Fair question. There's always kind of mini booms too. Right now, I just attended YC demo day yesterday, and there's all these apps that are Uber for X or Stripe for X. So mini booms can launch around some really innovative entrepreneur coming in and kind of transforming user experience in a certain way, which then becomes a horizontal. So Uber for X might mean a simple mobile app where in one or two taps I can get a service done for me. So then you could have an Uber for having your dog walked. You press a button, somebody picks up your dog, et cetera, right?
Uber for laundry, et cetera.
Yeah, Uber for laundry, there's a new one in YC called Prim. It does that.
Yep.
There's all these. So that's kind of like a mini boom, is like, oh shit, look at this idea, let's all jump on this. If you know where to look, there's always opportunities like that. Although they're not always as big as the ones you get, like the .com boom.
Here's number two. Craft your referrals, your buildables. And you say that this is 60% of Dropbox's business. What do you mean by that?
So everybody talks about wanting viral or referral marketing built into their product. This isn't just something you get by bolting on like a Facebook invite or Facebook feed mechanics. You need to have core value in your product that makes it shareable, that makes it a better experience if you're using it with your friends. Mm-hmm. And then I think what I was saying in the statement that you repeated was that it's expedient to package it in a fun way. So in the case of Dropbox, they have this concept of hard disk space that you get when you invite a friend. It's almost like you feel like you're building a hard drive and your friends are helping you build it and they're helping you get more and more space. There's almost a real world analog to that. And people used to build barns together in the past, right? So there's kind of that feeling that feels very, very, very real and very, like, very earthy. I don't believe there's really anything new under the sun. So if you're making some new kind of modern product and trying to find a referral mechanism for it, you know, look at some analog in the real world and play off of that. We did this in Farmville. We had a literal barn you could build with your friends. They had to come in, 50 of them had to help you do it. And people did. They sent hundreds of millions of invites a day for barn help. It was ridiculous.
Number three, tweak your value proposition, especially if referrals don't work, and make sure that it's shareable.
So as I said, a lot of people who are seeing like kind of issues with their KPIs, they're not monetizing, or people aren't inviting friends, or they're not as engaged as they'd like. Most of these issues come back to just not having built something that people want. Like you skipped a couple of steps and you just said, oh, I intuitively think this is going to be awesome. I'm going to build it and then I'm going to start pushing traffic at it. You know, and you're not seeing conversion rates that other people did. So the first step is always to do those tests, make sure you have core value. In the case of Uber, it's transportation. People like transportation and they like convenience. They also like luxury. They like to show off. They like kind of a white glove experience. It's all those things rolled into one that people already wanted. That's why it worked. The execution early for Uber was actually pretty shitty. I was talking to a friend of mine. He said that he was looking at seed investing in Uber, and he played with the product. He tried to plug in his credit card number, and it didn't even work. It wouldn't take his credit card, even though it was a valid credit card.
Wow.
So he passed on investing, which was a mistake. So all these products, like if you really found a need, a real need, you can mess up a lot and still succeed. If you haven't found a real need, no matter how well you execute, you will not succeed.
Number four, you'll probably need to become an SEO ninja. And you've seen people say, I don't care about SEO, and then what happened with them?
Yeah, well, this is this piece of advice was more for people running web businesses, and I guess could be generalized to when you start a business, there's a lot of pieces to that business that you have to deal with that you're not gonna like. In my case, it's SEO. When I make a website, I know I have to tune the page so that link, you know, versions will show up on Google and people will find it when they search. I don't necessarily like that I have to do that. I'd rather sit there and just build beautiful products and talk to customers all day. But that's not the whole thing. There's a lot of dirty work that goes into building a product. So this was kind of the point I want to kind of drive home and deliver with this is like, is look at what's important to the business you're building and make sure that you're ready to do everything you have to. Otherwise, don't even start it. So you do 80% of the work, you'll get 0% of the result.
And just because I know a lot of people read the transcribers, we're saying SEO, search engine optimization, and before he said KPI, key performance indicator. The next one, we have two others that are left. Tip number five, your days are numbered if paid marketing is your only sustainable strategy. Zynga was buying how many ads on Facebook at its height?
A lot of ads. Zynga was spending, in some cases, $1 million a day on advertising.
Wow.
So it's a strategy to kind of get rocket fuel to get out ahead of the competition. But if you're in a market where paid marketing is kind of the only way companies differentiate themselves, you end up running into this kind of race to the bottom on margins, so to speak. Let's say I'm running a subscription shoe company like Shoe Dazzle. This happened to them actually. And you know, I've noticed that I can acquire a customer for, you know, $50 worth of advertising, and that customer on average is worth, you know, $60 in the margins I make off shoes over the course of, let's say, like a 12-month period, and then they unsubscribe. So I'm making $10 on that, which is great. But then a competitor comes in and they're willing to pay $55 for those same ads to get their product out, because maybe they just raised a lot of money from a VC and they want to get out ahead and they want to have a good Series A. You see people even spending over the cost of acquisition, or the cost. You see people spending more than the lifetime value on advertising, just sometimes to juice their numbers. So when you get into a market like that, it's that competitive, you just can't sustain the business.
All right. And finally, offer cookies. That's tip number 6. What did you guys offer cookies?
So I was actually, I told you about, you know, going to the park and testing the restaurant idea. I was in a different park, testing out a business I was working on about 6 months ago. It was a kind of a dating therapy and counseling platform for middle-aged women. So we actually went to this park. We had a box of cookies and a sign that said free cookies. People came up, we'd give them a cookie and we'd say, hey, do you mind playing with this app on the laptop? It was great. When you give somebody something tasty, get their attention and talk to them. It's pretty amazing what you learn from just free form conversation with a customer. You learn so much more than you would from a survey, from a structured survey you push online. You can drill in on kind of whatever questions you want. So this is just the age old like focus group concept. Like, do focus groups, talk to customers, make it fun. And you know, even if that's not fun, you don't want to take your Saturday at a park to talk to customers to do it.
All right. I know that you've got to go, so I'm looking to make sure that I've got your webpage. What is your personal site? I thought I had it up on my screen here, and I guess I don't.
It's just rogerdickey.com, rogerdickey.com.
Okay.
It's going through some updates in the next couple of months, but for now it's got the information at least.
It is a good way to find you. Thank you so much for doing this interview. And before I also want to say to not just the audience, but especially to the premium members, thank you so much for being premium members. In addition to getting courses and interviews with hundreds of entrepreneurs as part of your membership, you also are funding the pre-interview process that went into making this interview helpful for you and for everyone else. You're also funding the research that goes into doing these interviews. You are helping to make these interviews happen, and I really appreciate you doing that. So thank you for being a Mixergy Premium member. And if you're not and you're curious about it, just go to mixergypremium.com and sign up. So thank you to premium members. Thank you to the viewers who are watching for free or reading or listening to the audio, however you prefer to take it. And Roger, thank you for doing this interview.
Certainly.
You bet.